Instructional Designers in Offices Drinking Coffee is brought to you by Domino, makers of Domino One, the all-in-one cloud-based e-learning authoring tool for teams. You can learn more at domino.com. That's DOMINKNOW.com. Now, here's this week's episode.
There's the theme music. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, everybody in the chat. Happy chair dancing moment. Hope that helps your Wednesday go along well.
Everybody wake up.
Yeah. Have a sip of coffee while you're here. Or tea. Or beverage of your choice.
Or beverage of your choice. Where for you folks in the UK, it's probably happy hour, so giddy up.
It's a happy hour somewhere. Isn't that the phrasing?
It's always happy hour somewhere.
No kidding.
We got weather reports coming in from all over.
Yep. Cool and crisp in Austin.
Nice.
It's beautiful and blue today in, Maryland? Someone was noting earlier. It's a gray overcast day here in Eastern Ontario today, he said, looking up out the window, acknowledging the fact that he's in a basement.
We have a cooling trend happening in Arizona. We're under 100 degrees.
Yeah, as a Canadian, I just don't even understand what those words that you just used. I have no way to relate. I don't understand. It's outside of my experience. So anyway, good morning, gang. We have Frank Nguyen with us here this morning, joining us for our weekly chat here. Frank, say hello to the folks and just give us a bit of an introduction bio in case folks haven't met you here before.
Yeah, appreciate it, Chris. So good morning, good afternoon, depending on which world, part of the world folks may be in. My name is Frank Nguyen. I've been in the learning space for a long, long time. Matter of fact, Brent and I go back 22 years.
Don't use
like
numbers.
Yeah, sorry to date us. Matter of fact, you and I were both instructional designers at a small little company called Intel. And since then, I've kind of moved into some different spaces, mostly learning and tech. I think I was at Intel for maybe 7 years, if my math is right, Brent. And then American Express for another six. Was a director of learning innovation there. Ran learning for Sears for about 4 years. Then was at AIG, and then now, currently, I lead learning for a small company that I would say delivers boxes of smiles probably to your front door. So that.
Very cool. And that's a heck of a path that you've had, a heck of a journey. And that's really what we wanted to talk to with you about today, because we do a lot of shows on and episodes around functional things, making, you know, e-learning experiences better, pragmatic things. But we don't often, you know, move outside of the sort of core idea of, you know, focusing on things that help people make things better and thinking about the broader pathway, you know, that a career might have. And that's what we're going to chat about here today. Maybe share with us a little bit, maybe starting with, I don't know, some of the earliest lessons you learned moving away from the sort of the role of a maker or you know, a creator, and then further up on the ladder.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, it's an interesting transition, I think, moving out of an individual contributor and instructional designer role where you're building and then to leadership roles. It's, I think the first thing that hits you is, boy, I'm doing a lot of work, but not really doing any work. I'm not really producing anything anymore. It's not a tangible asset. I won't lie, like one thing that I really miss the most is sitting down with some other instructional designers, talking about a business problem, whiteboarding it, figuring out what does the design of a curriculum or a course look like, and then building that and executing on it and seeing something real and tangible. So I mean, the things that I do now, probably than the last 10, 15 years, take, you know, as before as a structural designer, it might take days or weeks to produce something tangible. Now it takes months or sometimes years to produce something tangible. So the delayed gratification is not as satisfying as it was as a structural designer, but I think the impact of what you can do and change an organization is larger, if that makes sense. So they each have their pros and cons, but for sure, I think it was a struggle in those early months or years because it felt like I was not really doing anything tangible, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Even the ability to show somebody else what you did, here's what I did today, becomes a delayed sort of a thing or more abstract for sure. Yeah.
You got really good at PowerPoint and presenting to staff, right?
Yeah.
Here's all the numbers for this week. We had this many butts in seats. We've solved this many business problems, and this is what we're planning for Q4.
Yeah, PowerPoint was definitely an important tool for a long time. The role I'm in now is interesting because you know, you do writing documents instead of PowerPoints, but it's the same basic idea, right? It's articulating a business problem, helping people understand current state of things, helping them understand what it could be, and then what are your options to get there? It's the same basic premise to leading organizations through change, if that makes sense. So for sure.
So you've got the transition from actively making and then seeing things, you know, in that kind of fairly quick time around
you're
and being
higher up.
Are we out of sync? Maybe it's me.
Yeah, everything slowed down on my end. Sorry, it was probably me.
Okay. Oh, no worries.
I lost Frank.
No, I think Frank's still there.
Bandwidth.
I'm still here.
Okay. Let's talk about some other, you know, things that you had to learn as new skills or new unknown talents, discovering unknown talent, previously unknown talents as part of that shift, you know, along the way.
Sorry, I'm working on the mute button since I know it's got a little bit of echo in it. You know, I very much appreciate the journey I went on because I think it's one of my tenets as a leader. One of the things I believe as a learning leader is you have to be able to do the job of everyone on your team. So, you know, if you look at the composition of any teams that I've run, it generally includes instructional designers. It'll include facilitators that run training in class. It'll include technologists that build the tech. It'll include folks that do data, you know, BIEs or business analysts and whatnot. And so in order to, I think, really understand and direct those folks towards a vision and help them execute their work, you have to be able to get in the trenches and do the work with them and understand that work, right? So what I would probably say at this point is, like, I'm not the best software developer. I mean, Brent saw me do that. Early 2000s, I haven't done that.
Oh, come on. You were fantastic at it. Don't sell yourself short.
I was a bit of a hack at the time.
coding like crazy, you know?
Yeah. Not the best data person out there. I'm not the best graphic designer out there. But in a pinch, I could go out and do those roles. I'd like to believe I'm still one of the better instructional designers on the team, but that might be probably a fallacy. I haven't really done it in a long, long time yet. Brett will probably agree with that at this point. But
oh, come on. You're awesome. You are the best. You're exceptionally detail-oriented. I always appreciated that about you because I'm not.
Yeah. Devil's in the details, right?
It is.
So, So anyway, that's one of my key principles, Chris, is if you're leading teams, you got to make sure that you can do the role of everyone on the team. And in a pinch, you know, roll up your sleeves and go do it with them.
And get in there. How far? So when you first started making the shift, I know you did a little bit of management stuff at Intel, but when you first got a different role and you got into that leadership position, you know, did it, was it, I mean, you said it was hard making that transition and whatnot, but you know, what are those things from both sides of the picture. Like, if it was hard for you, the different things you have to learn, but what would you say looking back to those instructional designers that may get a new manager, somebody like yourself rolls into a position managing them that really is a little bit green when it comes to doing the that side of the business? How can they help, or what can they know about that to be more successful?
So, you know, as I think about the leaders that, I mean, you and I had, Brent, like we had, Larry was one of our key leaders, and, you know, he and I are both laughing because Larry was, I think, a good visionary, but not a good leader. It was pretty tough, right?
Yeah.
How do you help someone like that? I mean, at the end of the day, it's your success is their success, right? And I don't mean to say that in a nepotistic way or, you know, round-nosing way, but if you understand where the organization needs to go and where your leader is trying to go and you align your work to that, that's to me the best thing you can do. And that's been consistent for me throughout my whole career.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, go ahead, Chris.
Well, it relates to a question that Amy Kay has asked. By the way, Amy Kay is our guest in 2 more weeks. So we're having like a crossover episode here, just like they do on the big television networks, right? Amy's asking, related to this topic, do you find being a director of learning requires you to be skilled at managing direct reports, or is it more important to focus on strategic big picture thinking and communicating with the C-suite?
Yeah, no, it's a super good question. It varies by the day. It probably varies by, I think, your tenure in a specific role. And so what I mean by that is, you know, if you're in your first 6 to 12 months in a new role, whether it's, learning a new function or leading a new learning function, I think it's super important probably those early months to engage with your people and team just so they know who you are as a human being and trust you. Because there's this period of time where people give you some grace and say, hey, I'll ride it out. But quickly thereafter, you've got to learn the business and be a student of the business and understand what the business problems are, and then act pretty quickly to set a strategy for the team. Like, here are the top 3 things we're going to do in the next year or 3 or 5, whatever it may be. And your people are looking for that, right? They're looking for vision and strategy and direction to help understand where they're going. And I think the words you use, Chris, I think are very key. It's one of your key roles as a learning leader is being the bridge between the business and their language and how they approach things and your team. I think, one of the things I used to say is my job is more translator than anything else, right? Mm-hmm. It's taking business problems, business vocabulary, business vernacular, translating those into learning solutions, whether it was tech or instructional design related, and then vice versa, is helping those learning professionals understand, here's what we're trying to go solve and here's how learning addresses it, right? Mm-hmm. So I spend most of my time probably translating between the two, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I would say that's probably got to be the hardest thing for new instructional designers to learn, and is you don't speak instructional design to, you know, the management, because they don't care. What does everybody say? Nobody wants to hear how the sausage is made. You know, that's your job. You just do it. You have to speak in their language, in their terms. And I really do. I think that's one of the hardest things. I hear it all the time with folks. My manager doesn't understand me. You know, I'm explaining why this, you know, Gagne's events of instructions I'm using mm-hmm. all the time. And, and they're spouting off all the academic stuff and, you know, they just won't listen. All they end up doing is wanting what they want. And it's like, well, it's kind of, you know, how do you coach your people to kind of get past that? Or do you just say, hey, I'm going to go ahead and handle that for you. It's okay. I'll take care of it.
No, for sure. I think more and more, what you realize as your teams get bigger and the business gets bigger is you can't be everywhere, right? You've got to teach more than you do, if that makes sense. So
yeah,
I probably spend more time explaining to people what my mental model is on a particular problem, talking through how I think about it, so that when they have that conversation or encounter a problem, that they know how to address it themselves, right? And so that's how you scale yourself as a leader is, I hate to say it this way, sort of cloning and replicating yourself, if that makes sense. Right.
So, well, yeah, you're acting as a coach, right, to all of these folks. It's very much that, I mean, sports analogies often get used, maybe sometimes too much, but it really is that good. If you're going to have a good team, when you get to your position and you take on those roles and those strategic roles, you do have to become a good coach, which means mentoring, which means teaching, you know, the things that you've learned to them so that they can learn. You know, this must be a struggle. Do you let them make their own mistakes, you know, or do you find yourself having to hold back and not tell them how to solve the problem and let them do it themselves?
Yeah, I think 80 to 90% of the issues that someone may run into are ones that they could encounter and fail, and there's not significant long-term repercussions either for them or for the business. There's probably 10 or 20% where you've got to intervene and say, you know, if this gets messed up, it has serious ramifications, right? So, you know, for better or for worse, making mistakes and learning from mistakes is probably one of the best ways to learn. I mean, I could give you a book and ask you to read it versus experiencing it. And those are two very, very different things, right? So, and I even, not set up situations, but sometimes you run into two instructional designers, as an example, who are fresh out of school, super ambitious, have very different opinions about a topic. And I'm sure you've both seen this before. They go at loggerheads. Like, they can't get past that. And Brent, fortunately, you and I never had this, but we had some colleagues that, you know, we butted heads with. And I look back and, you know, our leaders there really didn't intervene in most situations. And so I'm pretty intentional about that sometimes. If I see two people going at loggerheads, and I feel like they're better off learning about how to collaborate and partner with people they don't necessarily get along with, I won't intervene. And sometimes I've two or three situations in my career where I said to them, like, look, I know you want me to intervene here. I actually think you and this other person are actually closer than you realize, and that's the reason why you have this friction, right? And so I'm not going to get in the middle of this. I'm going to let you both work through this, and in about 2 or 3 months we'll have the conversation about, you know, it was painful at the time, but they appreciated it later. And then I've literally had that conversation with folks. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to set people up to fail, you want to set people up to have conflict, but they're valuable lessons in failure.
Mm-hmm. It's also balancing the you know, the micromanagement of people too. You have to provide them space to come up with things so that they feel an ownership in the solutions being created, etc. Without you know, having to be involved and touching on everything, you know, as well, and them having faith and confidence in you that you're going to be, you know, be there when you need to be, but also giving them the space to come up with something that they can bring a part of themselves to the project as well.
Yeah, I think that's a super interesting way to think about it. One of the first things I tell people that start working for me on a team is I tell them, look, I'm going to be here to support you as little or as much as you want. And I start actually out with as little. And it's not meant to be, I'm not here to support you. I'm not going to leave you out to, you know, to dry out on your own. But in general, my thinking is, you know, we talk about the work that needs to get done. We agree on what that looks like. We agree on when it needs to get done. And then after that, like, you let me know if you need help. I think empowerment is a key motivator for people as human beings in our work. I think the best that you can do is align what people are interested or passionate about to the work. It's as you all know, it's hard to get up in the morning and do something that you don't love, right? So if you're able to align people to work that they love, you agree on the work, you empower them and get out of their way and only be there to help them when they need it. I've always been blown away, Chris, is like I for any given problem, I usually have an idea or an opinion and I usually share it. And I say, you can either choose to use it or not. And I'm always blown away by how creative people are. I mean, 9 times out of 10, maybe even more than that, people exceed whatever it was that I had even thought possible.
How do you deal at the strategic level with the shiny object syndrome, or are you over that? Like, you know, do you ever still either get some of those fresh green instructional designers or maybe managers at your level coming to you saying, you know, hey, there's this really cool new virtual reality thing. We totally have to do it for this, or where we want to use QR codes, or, you know, all that kind of stuff. Or yourself, you know, do you still kind of suffer from that, or have you been, you know, into it too much? Or when you're at your level, do you get to just throw money at everything and try it all, and it's just like Disneyland?
I think there's two ways to look at it. I think internally from a learning perspective, and then from the business perspective. I'll answer it two ways, Brett, that shiny penny question. So I don't know, you know, it's interesting you ask that, because I remember years ago, you and I were both, you know, Apple junkies. I know, Chris, you didn't want us to mention brands, but, you know, I think I had an iPhone 2 and then a 3 and then a 4. Like, I had every version every time an upgrade. And I know you loved Macs as well.
Yep.
And it's just interesting. The last 7 to 10 years, like, I just, new technology that comes up, I now, instead of early adopter, I've become a little bit the lagger, a little skeptical at times. Like, prove to me that it can actually make my life better.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I approach new learning technologies, I mean, you and I have just seen the cycle of the years, right? I mean, we've worked on learning content management systems. I don't even know anyone who's, you know, running learning content management anymore. I did performance support as my dissertation topic. I mean, that's still kind of out there. You know, you've got all these personalized learning systems. Anyway, you know, technology evolves. And so I think the number one key tenet I have now, Brent, to your question is, rather than have a solution and then go look for a problem to fit it, I start with the problem, right? And I actually go out of my way to say, hey, I have this business problem. It looks a lot like something I encountered 5 or 10 years ago in another company. And I know exactly how I solved it. But I actually go out of my way now to not try to immediately adopt what I did before. Like, I try to do a different play every time. And I think a quarter of the time I should go back to what I'd already had done before. But it's sort of my way to force myself to disprove my own beliefs. Like, just because something I did was successful at Amex 10, 15 years ago may not be successful here in this situation, right? But sometimes it will be. So I think that's the number one thing that I do internally from a learning perspective. Now, the harder piece to what you mentioned, though, is the business. So this is a real story. 2000, I don't know what this was, maybe 13 or 14. I was running, learning for the retail side of Sears when I first joined that company. There was a sales leader. So this is not even a training group, but someone that's in sales was in love with YouTube and thought everything could be solved through an instructional video, right? So they sent in this request to the team.
Wait, that's not true?
Well, that's... I started to dispel that rumor. anyway, the team sends in this request. You know, we want 84 instructional videos in the next 2 months in advance of this big sales campaign for holiday. And because that was a shiny penny for that team at the time, was if everything's on YouTube, it's got to work, right? So I took, I don't know, a couple days and sat down with a database analyst and went through all of our stats for the videos and brought them all in a room. And it was me, a couple folks from my team, and probably about 30 other business leaders, and systematically went through the data and dispelled every reason why we should be doing 84 instructional videos for this. I was not a popular person coming out of that room, but it was exactly what we needed to do. We needed to go a different direction. Matter of fact, we ended up going more of a gamification, scenario-based learning direction, because it's sales, right? People need to learn how to interact with other human beings. So we took a very different direction with it. But it was one of the situations where I had to give the business what it needed, not what it wanted. And that's hard. It takes it takes a certain level of courage and maybe idiocy to stand up in a room of 30, 40 people and tell them that they're wrong.
Right. Yeah. Especially executives that have a little bit of pull, because I've always found that sales departments have a very a lot of clout within any organization, mm-hmm. way more than training departments typically. Totally. So
they are the revenue generator, right?
Right.
Yeah. Krista has a question that relates to this or connects to this. She's asking in the question panel, how do you bring awareness to a business problem that your learning team has uncovered? that the other business leaders do not acknowledge as a problem within your organization?
Yeah, such a great question, Chris. It some of it depends on the organization. And this is one of the important things to learn as a leader, is every organization is a little bit different in terms of how do you sell business problems and therefore learning solutions. So the organization I'm currently part of, and I think, you know, early days when you and I were at Intel, Brett, those organizations are data-based organizations. So Chris, you know, I'll share pretty candidly, like some of the problems I'm working through right now. I think we all know, you know, we're in pandemic, coming out of pandemic, hopefully, but probably still in it. We had the Great Recession, I don't know, 08, and right now it's being dubbed the Great Resignation, right? So companies worldwide are seeing massive levels of attrition. You know, typically, I'll see between 4 to 6%. There have been weeks where it spiked to 17. And there are job roles, specific tech job roles, where you know, people can leave and go to another company, make 2 or 3x what they're making anywhere else with a bigger title. So it's a really tough environment right now. And so the best thing that we can do right now is to help really illustrate through data in this organization where are the specific acute pain points, right? So as an example, I can show specifically where the number of open recs we have, that's kind of surface level data, but if you dive deeper within specific roles, where are the applications per requisition lower, right? We can look to see where are employees in certain roles historically, and what roles did they transition to? So can we actually build more tech population through, as an example, finding the smartest high potential hourly employees out there who may not have a 4-year degree or certification, and give them that 4-year degree or certification to get them to become a software engineer, right? And so in the environment I'm in and in other environments I've been in, it's been about data. Other organizations you're a part of are less data driven. And I'll name specifically, like when I was at American Express, you know, Margie is online. She and I were there many years ago. When I was at AIG, those are not very data driven organizations. And data is part of that. But what those companies tend more towards is what is the impact of what you're doing on customer experience, right? So Years ago, I did a big 7-digit pitch to the president of American Express on buying a performance support system and how we could use that to interface with customers so they don't have to call us directly, how we could put a second screen in all of our call centers so that when someone calls in, they would be seeing all the information about a customer in one screen, but the other screen, it's in real time bringing up learning information to help them support the customer. So that pitch had very little data in it. It was all more about here's how we can improve the customer experience and even change the business. It allowed us to move to something called a universal agent instead of an agent dedicated to certain product lines. So it's highly variable. What you need to be able to do is read the organization to understand how do you influence in that organization. Sometimes it's data, sometimes it's customer experience, sometimes it may be something else completely different. So you have to adjust your style based off of the audience.
That's a super cool project. Did that launch?
Which one? The performance support one?
Yeah.
Yep. It did. It did. That was a body of work in. Let me think about it. 2006 was when we did the pitch. It rolled out over 2007, 2008, just in time for the Great Recession. I'd argue if we didn't have it for that period of time, I don't know what we would have done. But it allows that organization to do more to focus training. Onboarding and training more on customer service, because customer service is the same if you're a call center or internet service agent. It doesn't matter, right? Yep. Whether you're doing travel or whether you're doing a credit card or whatever, it's the same skill set. And then you can focus the training more on that, and then the performance support allows you to deliver information real time on products. That makes sense.
It's really cool. Did you work with Bob?
Bob Mosier?
Yeah.
Not on that project, but he and Bob Conrad Gottfried and I have discussed it many, many times. So we've actually used that as a case study.
Oh, cool. Go ahead, Chris. I keep cutting you off. Sorry.
No, no. Well, so you were talking about, you know, the current pandemic and some of its ripple effects, et cetera. And Amy Kay's got another question in the question panel. What would you say to department leaders in any organization who have frozen learning development opportunities for team members since March 2020 because, quote, teams are short-staffed, so there's no time for folks to be attending learning?
Wow. I have to be honest. I actually have not run across that. To be honest with you, I think right now with so much broad scale attrition and people moving from role to role, I think as an employer, you've got to do everything you can to engage and retain your employees. So I'm number one, I'm surprised and I'm disappointed, Amy, to hear that. I think if that were to happen to me in this situation, I think there's probably a couple of ways I would go about it. I think if it was just for me personally or my team, I would probably say, hey, like here's what we are slated to do in the next, I'm making this up, 6, 12, 18 months. Like, what? Here's our roadmap. Here's the things we need to do. And as a team, here are the areas that specifically we need to upskill on in order to deliver on that, right? So as an example, right now, one of the key projects that my team is working on that I just moved over to this new role about a month and a half ago. One of the things that we're looking at is how do we develop programs to take employees that are in a one job role that's completely disconnected, reskill them in some other job role, and then make it easy for them to not even apply, but automatically go into those roles. And so those are things that my team has not done historically. So we're doing a lot of benchmarking and learning and development internally to help us understand what that looks like, right? So that's one approach they could take is targeted against what are the deliverables in the roadmap for the team. If you're looking at it more broadly, one of the things you could do is go look at employee exit survey data and see what are the reasons why people are leaving. I'll share, like, in the current organization, the top reason is career and development. And so if you look at that data and you dive a little deeper, it basically says, hey, I've been here 3 or 4 years. It's going to be easy for me to leave and get a promotion, quote unquote, and go somewhere else and then try to get promoted within. Right. So
Okay.
If you use that as your lever, you basically say, okay, we need to invest in people. We need to give them, development plans and give them training and development towards their next role, or else they're going to leave us. So anyway, different ways to go about it. But it again, kind of depends on the organization. Right now, I lean more towards data, looking at the broader organization and seeing what the trends are. And I hate to say it this way, but if you take data and you look at it a certain way, you can usually find a way to justify your position. Not meant to say back into it necessarily, but there are ways to look at data in a way that what is it that you're trying to push for.
And Jusely in the question panel is also asking sort of a similar question. How do you position learning as a strategic imperative, particularly in organizations where sharing information via PowerPoint or email is deemed as learning?
Ooh, good one.
Well, I have to be honest. I think it is tremendously easier if senior leaders in the organization already value learning and training intrinsically. That will make your life tremendously easier. I had a few jobs back where the CEO and chairman of the board was a big fan of learning and was willing to invest literally millions of dollars for about 2 or 3 years before seeing any ROI back from it. That made that job tremendously easier. It was a super hard job, but at least I didn't have to worry about trying to convince a senior leader that this was something important to do. In lieu of that, if you don't have that level of senior support, the best thing you can do for yourself is find business problems that are small and that you can impact a meaningful change in a short period of time. Get yourself deliver some quick wins. Not to say to market it necessarily, to make sure those senior leaders know what you did and what the impact is on a business side, not on level one smile sheets, not on attendance, but truly on the business.
Yeah.
And I think over a course of time, you can build credibility for yourself and your team and the learning function itself. I can actually think of a VP in my last role that was very, very skeptical of learning. and our approaches to it. She was an Air Force pilot, knew training what it looked like in the military. Ours did not look like that. She had a very specific sort of mental model of what we should be doing. And again, I always defer to giving the business what it needs and not what it wants. So that was kind of contentious at first.
But, you mean what it wants, not what it wants, what you know it needs.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But it kind of a similar situation over success of about 4 to 6 months. It was small wins that collectively rolled together. And I'd say now she's probably one of our biggest supporters, but that took time.
Yeah. And then looking at the time, we've got a little bit here left. Let's close out with an awesome question. I think it's awesome. You may not, Frank, but Ray has tossed it into the chat. Frank, what's your key failure and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ray. By the way, it's been forever since I've seen you, so it's good to see you on this chat. I'm not sure if you'll remember this, Brent, because I think I had moved on to a different team. But the first team that Brent and I joined, it was the e-business group at Intel.
Yeah, yes.
And you and I were there at a period of time where everyone was going online. You know, everything was brick and mortar, putting things online. So that was some of the first forays in the e-learning. Although I don't think we called it that, Brent. I don't think it had that name.
No, it didn't have that name yet. I don't remember what we. I think it was. I think we were still just calling it computer-based training, if anything at all. Yeah. It was just training.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean that was right after the CD-ROM days of computer-based training, right?
Yeah.
On the web.
Yeah, we were right in the middle of that transition, and when we were there, that's when 9/11 hit too. So it was around 2001, 2002-ish, right around there.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's interesting you bring that up because I think without 9/11, what we were working on wouldn't have made it. Like there was a lot of pushback, if you remember, especially in Asia. Like we're going to our factories in Asia, they didn't want to have anything to do with it.
Right.
And then once 9/11 happened, no one either wanted to travel or could travel. So therefore, you know, we had to stay the course with e-learning and web-based training. So that ended up being a success. Thereafter, I'm not sure you remember this, Brett, but we moved into performance sports, so taking our web-based training and linking it to tools. And so people take the training and be in a tool and access it both directions. That was also wildly successful. So then I moved over to manufacturing out of the e-business group. And I took a lot of the same solutions that made us successful on the other side of the world. And Ray, to your question, I remember shopping it around to different leaders. And at one point, a gentleman named Rajesh, and I can't remember his last name, but he said to me very pointedly, he's like, it feels like you've got a solution looking for a problem. And what dawned on me, again, it's something that's colored my approach to these things over the years, is, again, you know, you can't think that what made you successful in past instances will make you successful again. It was a different organization. It was in the same company, but a different organization with a different audience, with different problems, different constraints. And so you really had to start from the ground up. And whatever successes you had, maybe you'll get to play that card 1 out of 10 times, but you've got to start from the beginning and not believe that what worked in this other group in the same company will actually work there.
Mm-hmm. Engineers are really blunt. I remember that, especially engineers that turn into executives. Don't pull the wool over anything. They'll pretty much just, they come right at you.
Yeah, he did not soften the edges at all.
There's got to have HR in the room almost every time. Yeah.
And having a success at one point in one position does not necessarily create a template that can be applied then everywhere afterwards.
Yeah. And it comes down to the solution. Like you can't say that. I'll back up a little bit to maybe provide context to how I'll answer your question, Chris. Is a lot of times I think of learning leadership as, that's interesting that you used that term coaching earlier, Brent, because I think it's a lot of that. It's developing plays and having a playbook. And I don't know, at this point in my life, I might have 30 or 40 plays. I don't know. I've never really sat down to do the tally. I probably should actually do that at some point. And it's knowing, Chris, that, you know, you have this playbook and you may never run any of those plays, but if you run into an instance where it's similar enough or a prior play will solve the problem, you pull it out. And Again, very rarely do you do the same exact thing, but you might run something very similar to that. So it's collecting solution sets that you use to either adapt or apply to future situations. But for me, I've always more enjoyed learning new businesses, new organizations, and coming up with new plays. I actually enjoy that more than I enjoy running a prior play. Although running a prior play goes fast. You know how it works. And you can get some quick victories that way to get your credibility. But I don't know. I just don't find it intellectually interesting or stimulating.
Get a nice mix. All right. So I'll drop in the last question here, sort of a future question. I mean, we're getting up there in our careers, right? So what's, you know, are there any solutions, like big solutions, again, that you've been dying to implement that you just haven't been able to lately, that are any technologies that you're like, you know, I've just never done that, and it would be cool if we could do that?
Yeah, you know, we're we've teased at, oh, I'll just say this, like I've been around long enough that I've seen the evolution of learning management in various flavors. You know, you have the old days where it's just like assign someone a course, they take the course, and kind of this sort of compliance mindset. As a matter of fact, I think during 08, 09, we sort of created this approach to compliance training where it's like, this is your job, these are the attributes, and these are the training you need to take, right? So that level of personalization. You know, we're at a point right now, Brent, where we have big data, which no one said probably for a few years, but we have all this data about people and our employees and their work history, where they want to be in their career. Like some of the systems will provide you a perspective on career trajectory. Yeah. We have other data that's historical about other people's career trajectories. We have machine learning and AI. We have all the component pieces right now to affect a really significant revolution in how we engage with employees and say, hey, like, I know all this information about you and who you are, and I know all, and we have all this content. You know, most big companies are probably sitting on libraries of thousands, if not tens of thousands, of pieces of content. But as you all know, the more content you have, the worse it becomes, because you can't find anything in that haystack.
Yeah.
Right. So I think we have all the component pieces to deliver, you know, personalized learning in pretty compelling ways. I think one of the ways that I've thought about it over the years is, you know, you go to one of these retail websites and you buy something, and then a day or two later, it's like, hey, you might also be interested in buying this. And you're like, how the heck did it know that? Right? Like, it's a little creepy. Well, we have the capability to do that from a learning perspective, but
we can do that for HR too. Yeah. You know, this has been awesome, Frank. Thank you so much for hanging out with us today.
No, I appreciate you having me.
Always good to catch up. Fantastic conversation. And, you know, and you draw a unique crowd, I will say. So many people in the chat I have not seen in a long time. Thank you guys for hanging out with us.
Yeah. And speaking of hanging out with us, folks, we have a LinkedIn group. Folks can follow up with some of these ideas and et cetera. Brent's probably got the link to toss in for that.
I do.
He will do that in a heartbeat. Frank, thanks so much for joining us. It's been fabulous. A really awesome session. And thanks for your insight and your sharing. Thanks to everybody in the chat, too. As always, great questions, both in the question panel and some conversation going on in the chat. We have the best chatty folks that join us. Folks, don't forget to sign up for next week's session, too. While you're here in Crowdcast, you can just take care of that. And we'll catch you guys all next week. In the meantime, let's dance on out of here.
Let's do that. We'll see you guys. Frank, awesome as always, again. Glad you're back in Arizona.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Take care. Oh, I better turn the volume up.
Give us one last boost.
If everyone's going to dance, we might as well make it loud.
There we go. We'll be right back.
Adios.